91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. We're at your service this afternoon about one of South Florida's most critical but underreported issues, condo and homeowners associations. Good afternoon, it's Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. For many, life in the Sunshine State begins in condominiums, but bring people together in shared living space and problems will emerge. With us this hour is attorney Donna DiMaggio Berger, who has specialized in association laws and regulations for decades. She writes the Community Association Law Blog, is a shareholder in the Becker and Polyakoff Law Firm, and a member of the College of Community Association Lawyers. This afternoon, we discuss the association rule changes wrought from the last session of the Florida Legislature. Topical Currents up next. First, the news.
And Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman with today's Topical Currents. We're at your service this afternoon with Topical Currents condo and homeowners contributor attorney Donna Berger. Her experience in the field dates back to 1992.
She writes the Community Association Law Blog and has worked with legislators, public policymakers, and associations in common interest ownership communities. She is a shareholder in the law firm of Becker and Polyakoff.
We'll hear about several association issues from the past Florida legislative session. Those are very important. But we'll also be taking listener questions. Concerning those questions, our program today is of general interest for association members or even board members. We're not discussing any specific legal issues or giving any specific legal advice. Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in, that's easy enough, 1-800-743-9576. That's 1-800-743-WLRN. Also, email, please keep them brief, radio@WLRN.org.
Yes, that's key. And perhaps you have an exemplary association or board of directors, and you want to talk about that.
That would be nice.
Well,
that would be refreshing to
welcome,
hear about,
Donna.
Right? Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Okay, well, all right. So when last you were here, there were four bills relevant to condominiums that were pending in the Florida legislature. Now that it's over, let's talk about what happened. We'll begin with Rene Garcia's Senate Bill 1682 to impose those criminal penalties on certain condo violations. Now, that's just waiting for the governor's signature, correct?
Well, that actually got wrapped up into House Bill 653. That's how that works out. You've got a House bill and a Senate bill. And
they were passed unanimously.
Exactly. Right. So we really, when we talk about the condo reform bill this session, it's House Bill 653. And that was actually the bill that I talked about with the engineered life safety system opt-out.
Okay.
So that started as that bill, and then portions of Senator Garcia's reform bill were placed on that bill late in the session.
So should we start with then the ELSS, or should we start with the criminal violations?
Whatever you want. It's your hour. But those things, so 653 wound up being a very large bill with, you know, a lot of different moving parts.
Okay. All right.
Some of this on the fire sprinkler business has to do with the height of the building also, correct?
Absolutely. 75 feet from the lowest level of entry to the floor of the highest.
Which would be 7 or 8 stories.
Typically, yeah, seven stories for a high rise. But you know, the long and short of that is that with the passage of 653, and we're hoping that the governor signs it, it hasn't yet been sent to him, but when it gets over there, he'll have 15 days to act. He can either sign it, allow it to become a law without his signature, or he can veto it.
Okay, let's just go over what it is again, because it's very confusing with this engineered life safety system, or ELSS.
Okay, so in a nutshell, older high-rises in Florida previously had until the end of 2016 to either retrofit with full sprinkler systems or to opt out of those sprinkler systems. And many of those buildings did opt out for a variety of reasons, but many times it was monetary because it was just too outrageously expensive for them to retrofit. So they opted out, and then at the end of 2016, beginning of 2017, the local fire marshals came knocking on their door and said, guess what? You still have to put in sprinklers, only as part of an engineered life safety system. Think of it as a scaled-back sprinkler system where you just have one head within the unit entrance or by the kitchen, but you still need the pumps to get the water up to even just that one sprinkler head.
So the pumps have to be installed throughout.
Correct. And so, again, once again, in many cases, the local fire marshals were telling buildings it's going to be, ELSS is going to be even more expensive, even though years prior it was seen as, it was sold as a more cost-effective alternative. So we went back to the drawing board and went to the legislators and said, guess what? We need to allow existing high-rises to also have the ability to opt out of this engineered life safety system. So that's, they now have achieved that through House Bill 653. And there's some other things that they have to do. They have to post signage. It will take two-thirds of the members to do this. But we believe many existing high-rises in Florida who previously opted out of the sprinklers will now go on to opt out of the engineered life safety system, again, if that's what their members want.
Now, if he vetoes this, that would be in the interest of safety? Because this still...
Well, remember, now, House Bill 653 has a lot of moving parts. It includes Senator Garcia's criminal penalties and a lot of other reforms. We are urging the governor to sign this bill. There is a, you know, there are other small groups out there that are urging a veto because they don't like those reforms. And we'll get into that. While we think the reforms could be, you know, better drafted, we don't think that they're bad, and in some cases we think they're actually quite good. So we're urging passage of 653.
Okay. One of the provisos is that condos of 150 units or more must file financial reports on a web page, which is password accessed. So
yeah, and House Bill 653 has an effective date, Joe, of July 1st of this year. But with regard to that website requirement, that doesn't come into effect. That has a delayed effective date. That doesn't come into effect until July 1st, 2018, which will allow associations of 150 more units to go out and get these websites and get them set up. Personally, I think technology can play a very, very large role in creating more transparency in communities. And it's not for everyone, but that's where we're moving. And we have talked, last time I was here about how wonderful it is if you digitize your records, if you can embrace online voting. And we'll talk about that in terms of some of the criminal penalties in this bill
because
can it be avoided through the use of technology, like a website, like having your documents digitized and uploaded, and like using online voting to avoid fraud in your election
because
process.
Because one of the big gripes has been refusing to divulge documents.
And again, it's the owner's documents. The only time that you don't want to divulge that is when you've got privileged information. You certainly don't want people looking at other people's rental applications that has, you know, sensitive information like date of birth and social security number and phone numbers. People take their privacy very seriously. But for everything else, including bids, including contracts, including the management agreement, including the agreement with the law firm, across the board, those are the members' documents, and they should be entitled to inspect them. Now, on the flip side of that aisle is the fact that owners should be also be respectful and not use the inspection process as a tool to play gotcha with the board. Because I've seen that. To bury them in paperwork. I've seen owners make repeated requests and then not show up. Make an appointment. Everything's ready. They don't show up. Because for some people, the goal's not really to see the documents. The goal is to be a little thorn in the side, you know? It cuts both ways.
Let's talk about the board of directors' limitations on how long they can serve.
Oh, the term limits.
Term limits. I couldn't think of it. Thank you,
Donna. Dirty word in some quarters. The term limits have been kicked around back and forth for decades in Florida. By the way, thanks for aging me, Joe. But they've been talked about for decades in Florida, and often the argument is we can't find enough people willing to serve on these boards. Why do you want to put a term limit if we don't even, a lot of communities don't even have elections because they don't have more candidates running for seats available?
Exactly.
So they just roll over. In this case, the House Bill 653 says a director cannot serve more than 4 consecutive 2-year terms, which would be 8, unless 2/3 of the members agree that that candidate can move forward. The question that's coming up now, whether or not you agree with term limits or you don't agree with term limits, is what if you have 1-year terms? It wasn't drafted that way. It says very clearly 4 consecutive 2-year terms. So I suppose
That would be 8 1-years, right?
Well, no, it doesn't say that, it sounds like if you've got a 1-year term, you could just keep running indefinitely. This was my major problem with the bill, was related to drafting. It's that type of thing that you
it seems a little bit sloppy that they wouldn't have,
Then people complain that they have to call their lawyers for a legal opinion. But if it just said, a cap of 8 years for any board member, we wouldn't have this confusion. There will be opinion letters requested on that very topic, as there should be, given, the heightened liability post-session. Sometimes I think I look at this bill and I think it's the Lawyers Reform Act, the Relief Act for lawyers, because we're going to be getting a lot of calls.
The intent of the bill is to keep some board members from creating their own fiefdom, like the Politburo. In your condo association.
Did I ever tell you about my first experience in my own condo when I was straight out of law school? And I ran into one of those kind of boards with a board president who looked at me and my husband and he said, "If I like you, I'll approve you. And if I don't, you're out of here." And we were like, "God, I hope he likes us." So I'm very well familiar with the bad boards out there. And they do exist. But there's an awful lot of very good boards as well.
Okay, let's go to this one, because this one, directors are forbidden from receiving payments from the association or hiring their relatives, which I am curious about. Currently, directors can be paid for services such as cleaning, painting, and repairs, as long as all other directors are informed of the arrangement.
I always think it's a bad idea for directors to cross the line between volunteer service and paid service. So, directors, if you provided bookkeeping, you could be paid for that, for specific sets of skills that you were bringing. But you couldn't just be paid for serving on the board unless your documents provided as such, your governing documents, not just by board rule. Where some directors got in trouble is because they either waived assessments for themselves, and it's rationalization. I teach an anti-fraud class, and sometimes the fraudster rationalizes bad behavior. So saying, I'm putting in all this work, I should be paid for it, it can often be a rationalization.
Are any of these retroactive, by the way?
Oh, of course. No, it doesn't say that. And we can talk about the constitutional argument of a retroactive impairment. That's going to come up later in our conversation.
Okay, and getting back to the term limits, just to clarify this, if somebody's been president for 4 consecutive terms, can they then be treasurer, or they're not allowed to be on the board in any capacity if they have served 4 consecutive 2-year terms?
The statute says directors service, not officers. So again, this is going to be very document dependent, because in some communities, you don't need to be a director to serve as an officer. So keep that in mind. That's a little bit different. Some communities, in their documents, an officer does not need to be a director. But in terms of the term limits, they apply to directors.
Like the recording secretary.
Correct. Sometimes there's assistant vice president. So you're going to need a legal opinion on a lot of this stuff.
They didn't do it. We're speaking with Donna DiMaggio-Berger. She's a shareholder in the Community Association Law Practice of Becker and Polyakov. We're taking your calls, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576. Our email is radio@wlrn.org. And, I think we should get on to the other violations in terms of how does one know if violations are taking place, okay? How does I'm talking about someone who's not on the board. They're just they live in the condo. They want to know, they have a suspicion that something, that there is fraud going on of some kind, or there are violations taking place. What is the procedure that they're supposed to follow?
That's a great question. And one of the first things I would recommend is, if you think something is going on, start going to meetings. Start attending. Show up. I can't tell you how many times I've encountered somebody who's thought something was going wrong, because I represent both associations and I've represented owners too. So I represented both sides. And one of the questions I would ask is, when was the last time you attended a board meeting? Well, I don't go to them. Well, that's a problem. You do need to go. You need to put yourself out there. I know nobody likes to go to a nightly meeting after working all day, but you need to go.
And in the bigger condos, once they have the websites up, then those meetings could be carried live.
Well, sometimes they already have those on the closed cable channels, correct. So like Kings Point and Tamarack, they have their meetings taped and they're shown on a closed cable channel. So it's great. So for people who may even have mobility issues, they can watch it right from home. But I would suggest show up. Ask questions. Don't make allegations. Once you start making assumptions and casting aspersions and calling names, the dialogue shuts down. I don't care. You may be on the right track, but when you start casting aspersions, making allegations, and making assumptions without doing all your fact gathering first, asking questions first, now you've taken yourself off the right path, you've put yourself on the wrong path. And it's very hard for people to garner community support when they take that, you know, because that's the other thing I will say. Well, what do your neighbors think about this? Are you the only one who sees this? And sometimes these people are very isolated, but it's because of their approach. The problem could be a correct problem. They could have correctly identified a problem or a suspicion, but then the way they go about processing that can become very problematic.
Okay, so the first thing is to go to meetings. The second thing is to start asking questions, and they're obliged to answer these questions. Is that correct?
If you make a certified written inquiry where you've laid out certain things, absolutely. Understand the law. Educate yourself. Volunteer. Run for the board yourself. I've seen instances where people who were denied, Joe, you mentioned about the documents. One man came to me as the newly elected president of his community, and the reason he finally decided to run was because for years he couldn't get access to the documents. And he finally said, enough is enough, I'm going to run for the board. And he ran, and he was tenacious, and he got on the board, and he made changes.
You know, part of the problem is there's so much apathy, Donna, and I think people feel like they do in, you know, it's a smaller scale, but a lot of people don't get involved in government or civically engaged because they feel like they don't matter and they won't make a difference.
And I think maybe some are involved too much.
Well, that's true. But then,
are you saying some people need hobbies, Joe?
Let's take a telephone call or two. Our number, if you'd like to get in, we have some lines open. 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also email, that's radio@WLRN.org. First caller, we've got Lois in Plantation, Europe. Hi.
Hello. I wanted to know if the association is not maintaining the exterior of the building and there's water, you know, raining in and water damage, what is their responsibility on the interior damage, and also can maintenance and assessment be waived?
You're talking about water damage into your unit? And what options you have?
Right.
Hi, Lois. How are you?
Good.
So, Lois, is the water damage coming from the roof or from an upstairs unit?
When it rains. Coming from when it rains.
Okay. And are you in a condo?
Yes.
Okay. So you're in a condominium. When it rains, your unit is being damaged. Have you put the association on notice of this problem?
Yes.
Okay. And I'm assuming the reason you're calling in is because nothing's been done?
Right.
Okay. So a couple different things. I would look at the reserve study and see, you know, what the estimated remaining useful life is on your roof. I would see if there, I would confirm whether or not you have a fully funded roof reserve. I would attend the board meeting and find out and raise under new business whether, you know, what's being done with the roof. And if it's at the end of its estimated remaining useful life, I would ask, why are we not replacing the roof? In the meantime, since you're in a condominium, if your drywall has been damaged or your baseball board has been damaged, the association is going to be responsible for repairing or replacing those two items. You're going to hopefully have insurance coverage for the interior of your unit, which is called an HO6 policy. Hopefully, if you've suffered any other damages, you're going to contact your insurance company on that.
Look into mold issues.
Well, and again, you know, the association's responsibilities with regard to water damage in a condominium are very clear-cut under 718.111.11. But if an owner can prove that an association has been negligent in its response with regard to a water issue, then that association can be held liable for more items than they otherwise would have, including, you know, carpeting, furniture,
so it requires negligence.
It requires, yes.
What about the mold? What about mold remediation? That's the condo or that's the owner?
She's just saying it depends on negligence.
Right. So if you had documented months of contacting the association, they did nothing, and as a result, mold grew or flourished in your unit, then yes, you could possibly pursue them for mold remediation. But remember, as an owner, you also have a responsibility, Lois, to mitigate your damages. So if you have a leak, if you know that mold is growing, you should absolutely take steps to remediate mold, because the association can also pursue you should a mold situation in your unit spread to neighboring units. Mm-hmm. So I would urge you to immediately find out when the roof's going to be replaced or repaired.
Okay, thanks for calling, Lois.
Thanks, Lois. Okay, this is David. Is it possible to condemn one building out of a group of 8 buildings which are held under an HOA association? We're experiencing terrible assessments due to the dilapidated condition of one particular building in our HOA association?
Well, you know, a lot of people use the terms HOAs when they really mean condominium association,
okay,
or
so
maybe called. So I'm assuming if it's multiple buildings, he's probably talking about a condominium association.
Okay. He says, is it not possible to declare the building as condemned, move the residents out for a fair price, and be done with constantly having to repair the building? I figure paying off the residents for the condemned building will be less expensive than 20 years of assessments currently being levied against the remaining residents.
Okay, well, I would urge David to look at his documents, and I really think what he's talking about is not a condemnation, but a termination of the condominium form of ownership, where you would terminate the condominium. You could sell the building then, and everybody would go their separate ways, hopefully having made some money. It doesn't sound like he's talking about what we call a voluntary termination, which is a developer comes along, says, I want your property, and this is what I'm willing to offer you. With that, you need 90% approval. That this was just increased from 80%. You need 90% to approve a voluntary termination, and not more than 5% of the other owners to object or try to block it. But what he's talking about is if the building is really in such dire straits in terms of the condition, then it may be an involuntary termination, which means he should look at his documents to see what it says about a building that has not been maintained. This typically comes up post-casualty, post-hurricane.
Mm-hmm.
Buildings demolished, there's not enough insurance to repair it or restore it, so you'd make the decision to just terminate the condominium form of ownership.
Okay. More emails? Or do you want to
more emails? Let's...
Okay, let's go with the John in Fort Lauderdale. John, you're up. Hi.
Hi. Yes, I was listening to the beginning of the show, and I remember you talked about every member should make an attempt to go to the meetings and ask a lot of questions. Well, I went to the last meeting, and the board decided, apparently because too many questions had been asked that they didn't want to answer at previous meetings, that they would only discuss agenda items, and there was nothing on the agenda. And then they also had a police officer that they paid $150 for to be at the meeting, and they said, if anyone asks questions that's not to be discussed, we're going to have you walked out of the room. Hmm. And I just wondered, is that allowed?
That sounds pretty... Well,
your building sounds fun. But no, I will tell you, I have been at meetings where that has been the protocol. And sometimes that has been the protocol because it's born out of an owner or a group of owners who basically hold the meeting hostage. Now, I don't know if you're new to the meeting or new to the community, but it sounds to me like there's something else afoot here where they would have, you know, taken those kinds of steps.
Maybe threats.
There could be threats. Right. I've been to meetings where you've got people that they just cannot, they will not abide by the protocol. You know, the statute says that an association can pass reasonable rules regarding participation at meetings, including limiting the time. By the way, this also applies to board members. I went to one meeting where a board member went off for 45 minutes.
Filibustering.
Thank you very much. It was filibustering. So, John, in your case, a couple different things. I would look at your articles and your bylaws, because often the articles and bylaws actually set forth the standard agenda for meetings. And if your association's deviating from that standard agenda and doesn't have a section for new business or good and welfare or something like that, you may want to bring it up. I will tell you, this is where having counsel weigh in. I will tell my clients, look, you want to be able to have people give input. It's you really want to strike a balance between having the meeting be respectful and allow everybody who wants to participate an opportunity to participate, but certainly not shutting it down. The fact that they've been so draconian here tells me that there's something really else afoot, that they may have been a problem, and this may be an overcorrection. Hopefully they get back once they've corrected it and they're working with council. They'll get back to allowing you to weigh in, and I think it's great you went to your meeting, and I hope that this experience doesn't, you know, dissuade you from continuing to go.
No, it doesn't. And there's one other thing I would like to add, that the president has her son, who is the treasurer, and he's also the paid bookkeeper. So this, so you have two out of the, I'm sorry, there's like two out of the five votes that's needed for a quorum, and that's usually the things people are asking questions about. You know, why are you paying this person? Why is he your son? There's just a lot of nepotism and things going on, and I guess they're the kind of questions they didn't like people asking.
Well, and you know, we're going to talk about criminal penalties later and conflicts of interest, and that's the type of thing that directors who've been doing this for a while need to know, that there's a completely changed landscape as a result of this bill, and if they continue to do this, it's at their own risk. You know, it used to be these type of things were just a PR problem, but now they can potentially land somebody in jail.
And what are the consequences? What are we talking about in terms of jail terms?
There's a sliding scale, but it starts at some of the criminal penalties are misdemeanors, some are felonies. You're talking 60 days jail time, up to 5 years in jail. Okay. So,
all right,
John. Good luck,
John. Thank you.
Here's another
John. He wants to know what type.
Before you move off that, I'm always interested though, because the statute prohibits co-owners from serving on the board at the same time, but certainly not relatives who may own different units. But I'm always surprised, why are people electing? You know, if they think there's going to be a voting block on the board, this is where an informed and involved electorate can play a big check and can impose a big check and balance. If you know that these people are related, then don't elect people on the board and get people to run so you don't have this.
Well, didn't
situation.
He also say that a relative was also the bookkeeper?
Something like
the
that.
The treasurer and the accountant.
And the accountant.
That doesn't
so
seem right.
isn't that hiring relatives?
Oh, well, yes, and that will be a problem post July 1st. That's a big
no-no.
Would
that be a misdemeanor or felony?
That's going to be with the finding. Well, it depends. It's a misdemeanor when you start out, depending what they do with
it.
You can wind up to be
fraud,
a felony,
it
correct.
Could be,
if there's embezzlement.
Dollar funds, yeah.
Okay, Donna DiMaggio-Berger, we're talking about homeowners associations, etc. And number 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576. Email radio@wlrn.org.
And we're back at your service. Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and attorney Donna Berger. We're talking about condo and homeowners associations on our program today. We have lots of calls and emails. Donna, with those legislative measures we've been talking about, do any of them affect renters?
There is a change under HB 653, which would now allow renters to request copies of the bylaws and the association rules.
Oh.
So that's a little bit different. A renter, up until now, only an owner could make a document inspection request or an authorized representative of an owner. But this new law will say that renters specifically...
That gives them a lot more power,
well,
I would think.
You know what, to be truthful with you, it didn't say that renters can attend meetings, that they can speak at meetings. It's the first little baby step, though, I think. And frankly, when I read it, I said, I can't believe that renters don't have copies of this stuff to start with. I know many communities that when they go through the application process with renters do provide them with the rules and regulations and the governing documents, because it's in the association's best interest that you have people moving in as renters that understand the regulations.
That leads into something you blogged about, and that's about the condos and boards can be arbitrary, have arbitrary decisions, and they make a big deal out of things in meetings when they could give a simple answer, such as the example you used.
Oh, the man with the pool.
Of why can't I swim at night? Instead of just saying, because we say so.
Right. Well, that sounds like John's community. So, you know, what can be a question can be very, a potential flare-up can be very quickly diffused if you can say why. Why can't I swim at dusk? Well, because, you know, it's, we don't think it's safe. We don't have a lifeguard. We want to cut down on electricity, whatever it is. But some boards feel...
Kids annoys or...
Right. Whatever it may be, if you can't answer the question simply why, and you know that blog was born out of the whole airline, United Airlines debacle, which is, why do I have to get off this plane? Tell me. Explain it to me.
We'll show you.
I guess he got an explanation of sorts.
All right, let's get to some emails because we have so many of them. John wants to know what type of information can be expected by attending board meetings. Can tenants get any information they want? I think you sort of covered that. But also our board decided to decrease the board number members from 5 to 3 without getting a majority vote. Is this legal?
Yes, it might be. Because typically when you have a swing board where it'll say not less than 3, not more than 7, then the following sentence will typically say the exact number to be determined by, and it'll either say the board of directors or the membership. So in John's community, if the articles or bylaws provide the exact number of the board sizes to be determined by the board, then what his board did was not incorrect.
That's really a small board, 3 members from 5. I mean...
It is. And sometimes I have communities with huge boards. In terms of John's question on what information they can expect to receive, that's going to be very dependent on the type of board that's, you know, elected in his community. Some boards are very transparent and they're very open and they go out of their way to be inclusive with the members and to send out various different communications, whether it's in a newsletter, on the website, meetings, direct mailings. And then there's other communities where... You know,
of course, fewer units would be necessarily probably fewer board members.
Well, that's
if you
true.
You only have 20 or 30 units.
Well that's true.
Like
and
that.
But sometimes I have small communities that have an 11-member board. More than 60% of the people are on the board. Also, to answer his last question, it's a big difference if a community is also professionally managed, because now you can do certain of those things when you have professional management in terms of communications that sometimes volunteer board members just can't get.
Which might include accounting. And
correct.
Back to our callers. We've got Jack in Miami. He's been on a long time. Thanks for your patience, Jack. Hi.
Hi, my name is Jack. I live in a condo in Miami that has quite robust services, and one of those is a receiving room and attendant to receive residents' UPS, FedEx, and Amazon packages. The challenge residents are having is the association only has that room and that employee open and working from 8:30 to 5:30 Monday through Friday and part day Saturday. So the growing population of working residents, where it used to be mostly retirees, can never receive their packages. They come home and effectively their parcels are held hostage until Saturday. And I'm wondering if there's any rules or laws that prevent an association from doing that with your property.
Well, there's not... Jack, there's not a rule or a law, but I'm just questioning the wisdom of the particular method that they're using right now. For instance, in your community, do you have any sort of a front desk?
We do, and it's separate from the receiving. So the front desk has somebody there who they say is not bonded, and their job description is not to deal with packages.
There's a very simple way to get around this. The way your association is doing this, and look, I can't, I don't work for your association, but you have a front desk feature, which means if the association said, listen, we will accept your packages at the front desk, just fill out a hold harmless agreement. Because again, from their perspective, they don't want, if something is damaged or lost, they don't want the association employee to be responsible. But I would assume that you and most of your members would be willing to fill out a simple legal form and say, leave my package at the desk, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Well, that's your answer. I mean, this whole separate receiving room and the employee, I don't know what they're paying.
So what are they saying? That employee is bonded, but the one at the front desk is not bonded?
That's what they've told residents, and the logic between the 8:30 to 5:30 is just that's how they've been doing it for the last 30 years.
Oh, gosh, I hate to hear that. Yeah, you know what? I suggest a change.
In the last month or so, I've collected signed letters from 38 residents asking them to extend the hours, and so far they haven't taken action, but I'm just wondering if there's anything that could force their hand.
Well, this is the type of thing, Jack, that a little issue like this can wind up having a whole new board come into control. I think what your suggestion should be, you may want to consider, rather than extending the hours, change the method entirely and have the front desk staff receive the packages and just have owners sign a legal document saying that they're agreeing to, and they're not going to hold the association liable for any damage to their packages. changes. It's standard. The way your association doing it is not standard.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
The other thing, Jack, I don't know about your building, but often in some buildings, when they do have a receiving department and they're about to leave, they take the packages and put them outside the person's door. I mean,
we've asked for that as well. We're trying to figure out if anything would be helpful.
Okay. All right. Thanks for calling.
All right. Thank you.
Okay.
And we go to Ed in Boca. Ed, you're up. Hi.
Hi. Hi. Good afternoon. I have actually two questions, if I can ask them both. First question pertains to basically when your company sends billing to an association, how long does the association typically have to pay that bill?
Depends on the company, doesn't it?
It depends on the company's invoicing.
Sure. Yeah, their terms.
I'm sorry. I didn't hear the answer.
It would depend on the company's invoicing terms, the agreement that your association has with a particular company.
What would typically be something that your company would do with an association?
Well, what do you mean by your company?
I'm sorry. Are you with Becker and Polyacore?
Oh, are you talking about my law firm?
Yes.
Okay, well, pursuant to our retainer agreement, to be truthful with you, I'm not certain about the exact terms.
Like 30 or 90 days?
No, it's not 90. I'm sure it's 30, typically 30.
Okay, so typically when I say your company, your law firm that I guess you work for, when they bill out to an association, they would have approximately 30 days
okay.
to pay the bill.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Go ahead, Ed.
Okay. So that's my first question. And second question is, why is it in Palm Beach County when an association denies an approval for, I guess, a tenant or a purchaser, that they are not required to give a reason why it was denied?
Well, you know,
I believe, for
yeah,
instance,
because they
Broward
don't have a, yeah, Broward has an ordinance, Ed, that says that when you deny an application, you have to provide a reason. Palm Beach County hasn't passed a similar ordinance. A lot is very dependent on the association screening criteria. But you also have privacy issues, too.
Well, how does one person correct the issue if they don't know what the issue is?
Well, if an owner is selling, okay, I would always urge owners to run their own background checks, too. Because it's important, let's say particularly for renters, not so much for a sale, but for a renter, sure, you're going to want to know who's in your property. So if you're running your own background check, you're also going to have access to whatever information the association has access to, which might lead them to deny the application.
I understand that, but it's still up to the association. And there are associations out there that are vindictive, and there are board members that are vindictive. And they can hold it up. So if that's the case, why shouldn't it be public knowledge, or at least not, maybe not public knowledge, but
yeah.
Why isn't the tenant or the buyer notified the reason they are denied so they can address it if it is something simple enough and correct it and then move forward?
Okay,
Ed,
I would recommend this. I would make sure that the screening criteria is being applied across the board uniformly, consistently. And I've seen owners push back and want to have a reason why. I would, you know, if that's the case, then you would have your attorney reach out and try to dig a little deeper.
Okay.
Not everybody can afford an attorney.
Well.
Yeah.
Again, I'm not understanding what is the difference between Palm Beach County and Broward County.
Well, it's very simple. The difference is Palm Beach County has not passed that ordinance. So then perhaps your energy should be spent urging your Palm Beach County commissioners to pass a similar ordinance.
Okay, we have to run.
Maybe it would be a good idea if BMP addressed it and pushed for it.
In terms of the ordinance?
Correct.
All right, something to think about. Thank you, Ed.
Thank you, Ed.
Thank
okay.
you.
We're speaking with Donna DiMaggio-Berger. We'll be right back and take as many of your calls and emails as we can get to. Stay with us.
And we're back with today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and attorney Donna Berger. Of course, she's a shareholder in the law firm of Becker and Polyakov, and is also has a community association law blog. She's also a member of the College of Community Association Lawyers. Where do we turn from here, ladies?
Some emails. Eric, what is one to do if you suspect corruption in the association? I'm no longer an owner. I sold the unit, and I'd like you to answer this generally, too. Okay, Donna. I originally bought it as a foreclosure, paid for two estoppel letters, and although the Florida statute only allows for claims of 12 months of back HOA fees, approximately $3,000, they tried to collect six times that amount, $18,000. After arguing, they dropped it to $7,000. I know something's going on because I bought the unit as an occupied property, but the person in it told me they were a personal friend of the property manager. It was vacant, but her friend, the property manager, gave her the key to live in it. It's much more intricate than this, but what's the best way to solve corruption in a condo for the next time?
Well, there's a lot going on with that particular email, Bonnie, and part of the problem is Eric may be suspecting that things are not kosher when he's a little confused himself. For instance, he said you can only charge a maximum of 12 months back due. Well, unless Eric is a bank, an institutional lender, that's not correct. That is the safe harbor limit of pursuing banks in Florida, where you can only go after a bank and pursue them for the lesser of 12 months past due assessments or 1% of the original mortgage debt. Okay. So that does not apply to an individual like Eric. So right off the bat, I can see that Eric has some confusion. That's not to discredit that there may be something else going on here. He's already left the community. But again, that gets back to what we said at the very beginning, which is ask questions, show up at meetings, talk to your neighbors. You can do this without rabble-rousing. By the way, I just blogged about defamation. If you start defaming people, if you start slinging accusations, you may be held civilly liable for penalties. You may be committing slander or libel. So be careful. Ask questions. Be tenacious. Run for the board. Sometimes when you're in that seat, you can get a bird's eye view. And by the way, I've had people who thought things were going off the rails. They got on the board and then they realized that it wasn't.
They weren't.
So, okay.
And we'll move along to another caller, William in Miami. Hi. William, you're up.
William?
Yes, good afternoon. Yes, good afternoon. I have a question. I just moved into a community a few months ago, and I am worried about a tree that is really high. And now with the hurricane season coming up, I think it's going to be dangerous for my property. I spoke to some of the owners around, and they say that that tree hasn't been trimmed for quite a long time. And I was looking at the laws of the association, and my community is supposed to be taking care of that tree, trimming and all that. Is there a way that I could pursue them to trim down those trees and, if something, God forbid, happened to my property, will the HOA association be probably liable for not trimming that tree?
So, William, a couple of things. A board's primary duties are to maintain, repair, and replace the common elements. So this tree sits on your common elements, and if it is true and you've confirmed that they've failed to maintain the landscaping, particularly June 1st was the start of hurricane season, well, that can constitute what's called a breach of fiduciary duty. So the board of directors has a fiduciary duty to all of the members to ensure that they fulfill their duties, both in terms of handling the financial operations of the association, as well as maintaining and ensuring the infrastructure. I think the first thing that needs to happen is your board needs to be put on notice that the community is concerned about the trees. Certainly, if you put them on notice and they
do. How do you do that?
Send a letter. You can do a certified written inquiry that we talked about before.
All right.
The association has to respond within 30 days if you send a certified written inquiry. Email doesn't count. You have to send it by certified mail. But in this case, it would be reasonable for you to write by certified mail and say, concerned about the tree, what are the plans to trim it? And by the way, if it doesn't get trimmed, and I'm assuming by your question that your unit is in the line of danger with this tree if it were to fall.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
I mean, and if I get more homeowners around from my property, because it's not only my property, it's about three more properties that might be in danger if that tree falls.
Do they send, they send it all together?
Sign it on all that?
You certainly can. But before you take that step, if you've tried to reach out and talk to them, because that always heightens the tensions on both sides. But I will leave you with this, William. Boards that are not responsive to the membership risk being voted out of office, recalled, or sued.
Well, I have another question also. I'm sorry I didn't listen to the program since it started. The lady that's in charge of the president of the board has been there for more than 8 years. I understand that there's a limit now with for how long that person can stay. I guess she will be voted out next period.
Is that retroactive?
You know, we have not
and
had
are they,
any.
And are they two-year terms or are they one-year
right.
terms?
Has she, exactly. Good point, Bonnie.
Yes,
you were listening before.
I was listening.
So, William, it all depends if, A, she's serving two-year terms, because if she's just serving, if your director's just served one-year terms and she's served 8 one-year terms, I don't think the statute even applies in that case due to the way it was drafted. Then again, as Bonnie and Joe both mentioned, it doesn't indicate that there's going to be retroactive application. And remember, the term limits are not solid term limits. Two-thirds, if this president has the support of the community, two-thirds of your members could say, we want, you know, she's doing a good job, we want her to move forward.
Okay.
Okay,
right.
William, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Okay, Janet lives in a third floor, on the third floor. The second floor owner did a kitchen remodel, which closed the telephone outlet. I want internet service from AT&T, but since it will go through the second floor, I can't get my service. The second floor apartment is rented. Management company doesn't want to cooperate, reopening the outlet. The HOA said I need to resolve the situation with the owner, but they don't want to cooperate. Any advice?
You know, I agree with the association in this regard. Often, owners are reluctant, and I understand the reluctance. Nobody wants to get into it with their neighbor, but sometimes the owners will sit on their legal rights, you know, vis-a-vis an owner, because it's easier just to send a letter or get angry with your board or the manager. In this case, if the neighboring owner did something which is impacting her service or her ability to get internet, she should contact her attorney and say, I want a letter, you know, I need to resolve the situation with this person and put them on notice. There are times where it doesn't make sense for an association to expend common funds on a matter, a legal matter between two owners. Think about it this way, Bonnie. If you lived in a building with 125 owners, right? And the association winds up getting into a dispute between two units. And you know how quickly disputes can spiral out of control. Mm-hmm. Do you want your assessments going towards resolution of an individual dispute? So this is a conversation that the association probably had or should have with their legal counsel to determine, is this a nuisance? Did this person illegally, materially alter the common elements? Is this something that is really a battle for the association to take on?
Or do they need to take
or it? Or is it a neighborly dispute?
Okay. Lewis says, where the bylaws are silent on the issue but provide that each unit has one vote, can co-owners of one unit both serve on the board simultaneously and hold board offices?
Well, the voting issue is not
related.
That's not related. Lewis, that has nothing to do with your question. Can co-owners of a unit, if your community is fewer than 10 units, the answer is yes. If those co-owners own separate units, so they may, let's say they live in one unit together,
but they own
another unit, then the answer is yes. Other than that, the answer is no.
Okay, Lewis. Let's see if we have time planted. I see the planted and the time planted. Donnell, there's a tree that was planted on the easement whose roots are breaking up the driveway. I was instructed by the HOA to cut the roots of the tree. I've done that several times, but the tree continues to grow and break up my brick driveway. What options do I have?
Donnell, you have to look at your documents. You have to figure out if that tree is the association. I know there's
an
association.
Oh, it's Carol, actually. Carol,
okay, sorry, Carol.
Yeah, me too.
Carol, is that tree on common area or is it on your property? Who planted the tree? Once you figure out how the tree is classified, then you need to look in the documents and see who's responsible for maintaining it. If the association has an easement for landscaping, it very well may be the association that's responsible to deal with those roots.
Well, we really apologize to all the callers and emailers we didn't get to. That just ran out of time. Donna DiMaggio-Berger, shareholder in the Community Association Law Practice of Becker and Polyakov, and she's also a member of the College of Community Association Lawyers.
So great to be here. Thank you for having
thank
me.
You.
Thank you so much for all the information.
And thank you for tuning in this hour. Apologies to William, Anthony, Pat, and our emailers that we couldn't get to you. We just ran out of time. Our lead producer, Richard Ives, technical direction from online content producer Jason Zepka. Polly Landis is associate producer. And perhaps a friend or relative would like to hear today's program. It's easy for them to do so. We have a free audio archive of each Topical Currents program at our website. That's WLRN.org. You may also hear our iTunes podcast and check out the Topical Currents Facebook page for links, photos, and more. Tomorrow's program begins with the West Palm Beach Public Library's unique Incremental U summer program. Then it's chef, author, and syndicated columnist, our friend Linda Gassenheimer. She'll talk about the Hawaiian food vogue of poke, raw fish salads. I don't know.
I do. They're good.
Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.
Joe, just because it doesn't have bacon in it, it doesn't mean it's not bad. Not good, rather.